Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much time and energy do Texans invest in their communities, and would the state be a better place if we increased public participation? While Texas residents have a reputation for being deeply proud of the Lone Star State, it turns out we don't always match our emotions with action, at least when it comes to voter turnout, volunteerism, and donations to nonprofit organizations. Regina Lawrence directs the Annette Strauss Institute for Civic Life at the University of Texas at Austin, which has just published the first ever Texas Civic Health Index. The report is available online now for free download, and Regina Lawrence is here to talk about its most interesting conclusions. Regina, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So you took data from the U.S. Census Bureau surveys on voting, volunteering, and civic engagement, which allowed you, among other things, to compare Texas to other U.S. states. And it turns out we finished near the bottom in a number of categories.
That's right. In fact, on almost every indicator of political and civic participation, Texas ranks among the bottom 10, and on some, very near the bottom indeed.
So what did you learn about voting participation?
Well, if you think of it as sort of a stair-step model of different forms of political participation, Texas, in the year 2010, about two-thirds of Texas voters said that they were registered to vote, but only about one-third voted in 2010. So 36.4% reported that they had voted, which put Texas 51st in the nation compared to all the other states in Washington, D.C. And then if you look at what happens after the election or between elections, less than 9% of Texans say that they had contacted or visited with a public official to express their opinions.
So essentially, a lot of us are just leaving it up to other people to make those decisions for us.
Well, I think that's what the data show pretty clearly, is that very many of Texas residents aren't actively involved in the political process.
So one thing, Regina, that you found might account for low turnout is the sense that elections in Texas are really not competitive. What gives Texans the sense that their vote might not count that much anyway?
Well, we have some data to go on here, and then beyond that, we have to rely on other research that's been done in other contexts. The Census Bureau data that we rely on did include a question asking people why they didn't participate or why they did not vote. And one of the main reasons people gave is that they either felt themselves to be too busy, or they had conflicting work schedules, or that they weren't interested or felt that their vote didn't matter. So those were the two largest categories of reasons that people gave. Now, when people say they're not interested or that they feel that their vote wouldn't matter, unfortunately, we can't, just based on this data, we can't really delve in and figure out exactly what people were thinking. But it is clear from the other research that a non-competitive election environment tends to drive down voter interest and turnout for this, for pretty simple and obvious reasons. The media tend to pay less attention to contests that aren't competitive, and the candidates and the parties themselves have less incentive to reach out and talk to voters when the outcome of a race is more or less a foregone conclusion. So it seems very likely that part of the reason for people being less involved politically here in Texas is the non-competitive elections.
And when we talk about non-competitive, there are parts of the state, there are offices in the state where after the primary is decided, there is very little chance that the opposing party has a shot. Is that what we're talking about here?
That is. I mean, if you look just in a general way across the state, and if we just focus on statewide elections, not getting down to levels lower than that where things get, in some cases, more interesting and complicated, but if you look just at statewide elections, of course, a Democrat has not won statewide office here in Texas since the early to mid-1990s. And the point here isn't just about what happens to voters who might support the Democratic Party come election time. I mean, of course, it stands to reason that their participation might be suppressed. But also, what happens even to Republican-leaning voters? Again, when the outcome is fairly certain, then there's not much incentive for even those voters to show up and pay close attention to the election.
Okay, so let's get back to the other factor that people listed, which was that they were too busy or their work schedules conflicted. What have some other states done to make it easier for people who might want to vote to actually cast a ballot, things that Texas maybe has not yet tried?
That's a good question. One that we have pretty clear data on is same-day voter registration, which has been tried in, I believe, 10 to 12 states around the country. And the evidence suggests that that can boost voter turnout, particularly among young people, interestingly. In the states that have enacted same-day voter registration, we've seen higher levels of youth turnout on Election Day.
So the situation in Texas, as I understand it, is that a couple weeks before the elections themselves, voter registration closes, which may have been, am I right, more necessary before we had the ability to sort of instantly, digitally get this sort of thing done?
Yes, that could certainly be part of it. Certainly other states are finding it easier to, you know, to do voter registration in different ways than we're doing here in Texas.
I was interested in this. Texans in rural areas are somewhat more likely to vote than those in cities. What might account for that?
That's a great question. I want to emphasize that those differences in the numbers are not huge. You know, we're not talking, you know, 20% more of rural voters vote than others. But it is true that the pattern appears again and again that voters in rural areas are slightly more likely to participate politically, especially in terms of voting, that particular measure, than people who live in the suburbs or in urban areas. The reasons for that, I think that's a great question. It's something we would like to delve into more and try to figure out.
What do we know about the socioeconomic correlation between voting, likelihood of voting or not?
Well, it's a very, very, very clear correlation. And in fact, it's true for various forms of civic participation as well. Mm-hmm. On political participation, if you imagine, again, a kind of a stair-step pattern, what we see is that those with the highest income and also those with the highest education participate significantly more than those at the lower rungs.
Which I suppose is all well and good for those who are participating, but those who choose not to ultimately, maybe without meaning to, cede more power to people who are already in a position to have a great deal of power.
Right. And this is true not just of Texas, by the way, but this is a kind of a nationwide pattern that higher income and especially education positions people and prepares people to be more civically engaged. So education in particular is very, very important. So it's not a pattern just here in Texas, but you're absolutely right that what that means is a kind of vicious cycle, if you will, that those who participate less get heard less, and also, frankly, there's less incentive for parties and candidates to pay attention to those groups at election time because they're not necessarily a good bet, if you will. If you can't count on a majority of, say, lower-income groups to turn out and vote, then there's less incentive to talk to them. So just to give you a concrete number, according to the 2010 figures, just under 50% of people who had less than a high school diploma were registered to vote, but 74% of those with a college degree were registered to vote.
And to the extent that people of like means might choose to make similar decisions, I suppose there's not a great deal of incentive for those who hold the power now to broaden participation?
Well, I do think that's part of the problem. Now, it's not something that we delve into much in the report, but my training is as a political scientist, so I feel comfortable commenting on that. Again, it's not particular to Texas, but it's true that candidates you know, for obvious reasons, need to focus on the groups that they think they have the best chance of mobilizing to actually vote on Election Day. And so they do tend to spend a great deal of effort narrowing the electorate down to those groups that they think are most likely to respond to their message and actually show up.
So at one point in our history, it was a big deal to get the voting age down from 21 to 18. But as it turns out, a lot of people wait until they're like in their late 20s, early 30s to start voting.
It's true. It's a terrible irony. Now, of course, there's Two things I would point out about that. First of all, we know that in 2008 and to some extent in 2012, we saw comparatively high levels of youth turnout, which still doesn't mean, 90%, but it does mean that higher numbers of young people turned out in those elections than in some previous elections. The other thing to keep in mind here is that there are two ways that age matters to political participation, and one of them is just flat out how old you are, and we call this a life cycle effect. And it is true that for some people, they will become more politically and civically involved as they age. As you, get a mortgage and your kids are in schools and you have a tax bill and all those kinds of things, you do tend to start paying more attention. But there's also what we call a generational effect, and this is what's really concerning, because the data show that young people today are participating at lower rates than young people of any previous generation for which we have data. So that means they're starting at a lower level. So even if they grow into greater levels of political participation, the overall level of citizen engagement is likely to be lower in the coming years.
So Texas has been a majority-minority state since 2004. What impact has that had on voter participation and on civic participation as a whole?
I can't comment on the effects because that's not something I think, certainly it's not something that we have studied, but I can say that our data show really clearly, again, this kind of stair-step pattern, and it's an unfortunate one. If you imagine these stair steps, the highest step is voting and other forms of participation among Caucasian Texans, and the next stair step down is among African Americans, and then a pretty significant bump down to the Hispanic and Latino Texans. So what we see is that those groups about which there is so much conversation right now, as you know, right, because Texas has such an enormous Hispanic population, but participation among those groups is really significantly lower than among other racial and ethnic groups in the state.
And do these statistics already factor in the reality that at least a significant number of Hispanic or Latino Texans might not be U.S. citizens, whether they're here legally or not? And does it simply look at those who are naturalized or who were born in this country and have the right to vote?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked. That's very important. So these census data do not they don't just look at ethnicity, they factor in eligibility to vote. So all of these voting figures that are in our report are based on people who would be eligible to vote.
How does the sense of trust in one's, if not country of origin, sort of historic country of origin of one's family, the sense that you can trust the government there affect the sense that you can trust the government here or that your voter participation matters in this country?
Yes, there is some research that we cite in the report that suggests that, in fact, one of the main determinants of recent immigrants' propensity to participate politically is exactly that. What was their experience of citizenship? What is their experience of their own government in their home country? So that is certainly an influential factor.
My guest is Regina Lawrence. She's director of the Annette Strauss Institute for Civic Life at the University of Texas at Austin. The Strauss Institute has just published its first ever Texas Civic Health Index. You can easily Google that and find it available online for a free download. If you want to be part of the conversation, maybe tell us about your own voter or civic participation habits. We'd love to hear from you. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director of the Annette Strauss Institute for Civic Life at UT, Regina Lawrence. The Annette Strauss Institute has just published its first ever Texas Civic Health Index, which you can find for free online. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Regina, a couple of months ago, we had a journalist called Erica Greeter on the show, who writes for the Texas Tribune. She was aware of the statistic that there is lower than average voter participation in the state, and she came away with the conclusion that Texans shy away from voting to a greater extent than people in other states because they are generally satisfied with the way things are. Does that correspond with your sense of things?
I respect Erica very much. She's fabulous and terrific, so I don't necessarily want to disagree with her, in part because I don't think we really know. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have the kind of research that could tell us for sure that, yes, in fact, two-thirds of Texas voters or people eligible to vote did not in 2010 because they're satisfied with the way things are going. As a political scientist, I would be doubtful about that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when we see, as we were talking about a moment ago, when we see that lower levels of participation are strongly correlated with these other factors like education, income, age, race, and ethnicity, this is not random disengagement. Mm-hmm. This is patterned disengagement. So personally, as a social scientist, as an academic, and also as a citizen, I would want to talk to those groups more closely in particular and find out why is it that they are less inclined to participate.
Going back to the issue of lower participation among eligible Hispanic or Latino voters in Texas, how does that group in Texas compare with counterparts in other states that have large Latino populations, Texas and Arizona and California, places like that?
Well, one thing that's very interesting is some research done by an organization called Latino Decisions, and this is freely available to your listeners online. Their study of Latinos around the country during the 2012 election mm-hmm. came away with one very interesting finding, and that is Hispanics and Latinos in Texas were significantly less likely to say that they had been contacted by a candidate or a campaign or a political party or some other group around the 2012 election. So that, to me, again, says something interesting is happening here in Texas, or perhaps rather not happening here in Texas, because we know that one of the biggest influences on people's likelihood of voting, this is across the board according to lots of research, is simply being contacted, being contacted by a campaign, a party, an interest group or nonprofit organization, particularly door-to-door, face-to-face kinds of contact. That's very important for many people to motivate them to get out to vote and to feel like they understand enough to get out and vote.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Katie in Grapevine. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I wanted to make a quick comment. Mm-hmm. I am a freshman at UNT, and I just took a political science class, so this is really, really interesting to me. And I learned recently about the kind of political culture in Texas and how it's very individualistic. And I wonder if simply living in a place like Texas would kind of accidentally breed that kind of apathy toward a politic or civic engagement.
Interesting question. What do you think, Regina?
I think it's a wonderful question, Katie. I'm always happy to talk to budding political scientists. and that's a factor that we delve into a little bit in the report that I would love to see us delve into more. In fact, those political scientists and others who study political culture in the United States would actually say something even more complicated about Texas political culture. Not only does it tend to be pretty individualistic and obviously leans more toward the conservative side in terms of, you know, believing in limited government, et cetera, but there's also a strong element of what the scholars call traditionalistic culture, which is more common in the southern states. And what comes with that is this additional ingredient of deference to elites. So we see that people in those states tend to have a greater sense of kind of social hierarchy and deference to people that are above them on the social ladder, and politically, economically, and socially.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Mark in Dallas. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Chris. I hope you'll allow me a brief moment to say I generally don't like interview shows, but every time I happen to chance upon yours, I always stop to listen. So
well, that's very kind of you.
You personally do a great job.
Thank you.
Hey, I am neither Hispanic, so I guess I can't address that aspect of things, but I am a liberal. And even though I do routinely participate in, you know, local and national elections, I question whether, you know, sometimes why I should, given the fact that in many cases, particularly in Texas, you have one choice, you know, one candidate from a particular party. And even post-election, I don't feel that people are particularly responsive to the electorate. I mean, Congress has a 10% approval rating for a reason, and couple that with the fact that I don't have the utmost confidence in electronic voting machines, I'm questioning whether I should even bother to go in there and pull the trigger. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Appreciate your call, Mark. Thank you.
I do think that that's one of the unfortunate corollaries of what the data show in our report. When you have lower levels of participation, it's either a cause or an effect or both that people begin to feel less engaged, less trustful. They have less sense that government is representing them. Now, we need to keep in mind, of course, that if people don't vote, I mean, what's the old saying? If you don't vote, you can't complain, right? So if people don't vote, there is a very real sense in which government may not be responsive to them because they haven't made their preferences felt. Mm-hmm. But I do think, and we are concerned at the Institute, that, as I said, one of the things that goes along with these low levels of participation is some sense of citizen disaffection from government.
So what's the difference between voter participation and civic engagement or involvement?
Great question. Voter participation you can think of as one aspect of the overall civic health of a community or of a state or of the entire country. So in the report we look at five different measures of political engagement, several different measures of what we call civic involvement, which is really non-governmental, non-political. It's the ways that people try to make their communities better through organizations that aren't explicitly political. So these are things like volunteering and donating and exercising leadership in a group in your community, even attending community meetings. And we also look in the report a little bit at what we call social connectedness, which are the census measures of things like how much trust people have in their neighbors and how often they exchange favors with their neighbors.
That was a really interesting find for Texas. So we trade favors with our neighbors maybe more than people in some other states, but we tend to trust them overall less.
Yes, it's a funny irony, and I have to admit here to not being a native Texan, my colleagues and friends who are native Texans are often struck by that paradox that we actually rank 16th in the nation for exchanging favors with our neighbors. So we're doing pretty good on that measure, but at the same time, again, we rank very low in terms of overall levels of trust in our neighbors. So it's an interesting paradox.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Tom in Wichita Falls who wants to know whether current statistics suggest that higher voter turnout could result in a Democrat being elected to statewide office.
Well, that's, of course, the $60,000 question, isn't it?
For the Democrats, for sure.
Yes, exactly. So your listeners, I'm sure, have heard about Battleground Texas, for example, which is the Democratic Party's effort to come into the state and mobilize those voters, particularly Hispanics, young people, single women, and others that haven't been voting in as high of numbers. I think, again, that the key question is a little unanswerable. The key question is, for example, Hispanics in Texas, will they necessarily vote strongly Democrat as Hispanics in some other states have done? We don't know that, and And at the Institute, we don't like to assume that identity is destiny, so to speak. Mm-hmm. People need to discover their own political values and their own ways towards civic engagement. So for us, it's frankly a less interesting question who will mobilize Texas Hispanics than the question of simply how do you build sustained engagement among groups that have been pretty chronically disengaged.
Sort of interesting here that the survey asked both whether people felt they were very liberal, somewhat liberal in the middle, very conservative, somewhat conservative in the middle. And those categories that people chose for themselves did not necessarily correspond to political party membership in the state the way we might imagine they would.
I found that particular survey very, very interesting. Yes, in fact, that particular pie chart that we show in our report shows strong and less strong Democrats almost equally numbering those who are strong or leaning Republican in the state, which is very interesting, as you suggest, because certainly our elections have not turned out that way.
Right. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here, this one from Karen, who says, I'm from the Northeast, which is civically active and more religiously diverse. How do you think the reliance on religious community affects individual involvement in civics?
That's a really wonderful question. I can say, again, I'm sorry to be a little general here, so many of the questions that your listeners are raising are exactly the kinds of questions that we at the Institute would love to delve into more. I think in general the evidence is clear that civic involvement is correlated with other kinds of civic engagement. Mm-hmm. So when people become more involved in their communities, it's kind of a gateway for political participation for many folks. So it stands to reason that at least for some people, if you become involved with your church, synagogue, mosque, whatever it might be, that you may then be more likely to also be more politically involved. So in a general way, we know about that correlation.
Any thoughts as to why women tend to be more civically engaged in terms of volunteering and making donations than men?
Well, yes. Let me just point out quickly that the numbers are not huge. The differences are not vast between women and men, but there is there's evidence that women are participating civically in somewhat greater numbers than men. And some of the reasons for that, I think, are pretty easy to intuit. Again, this is just a guess on our part, but it's often traditionally fallen to women to be more involved in the schools and in their children's education and in the PTA, for example. So to some degree, that civic sphere may be more of a women's sphere, if you will.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Cedar Hill. We have Barbara on the line. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I have a comment about the issue you were discussing about why some people might not vote, that they might be just happy with the way things are. I'm 65. I've lived in Texas for almost 30 years. I donate to Democratic organizations and out-of-state Democratic politicians. I'm actually considering just not ever voting again because I am so disgusted with the gerrymandered districts and the fact that Democrats in the state of Texas don't have a chance, unless maybe you live in the Austin area, don't have a chance of electing a Democratic candidate.
Well, not a statewide candidate. Let me jump in, Barbara, because there are certainly countywide elections in various parts of the state where Democrats have won.
Yes, that's true, but I guess I'm more concerned about the, say, the governor level mm-hmm. and the federal level.
What do you think, Regina?
We don't delve into that in our report. It seems clear, however, that just as has happened in other states around the country, redistricting tends to favor the party who gets to draw the district lines. And that's we cite some other research on that in the report. So in general, it's clear that redistricting the way that it is done in Texas, where it's essentially a partisan process, does benefit the party that has the majority power to draw those district lines.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Brandon and Tyler. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, thanks, ladies. Listen, I used to vote Republican or pull for the Republicans back in the day or whatever until I realized they weren't really supporting things that affected me, but rather very rich people. But I found out that here in this area where I live, the news media is basically an arm of the Republican Party. You don't hear two sides of any issues. Basically, 99.9% of the time, they have the representatives like Louie Gohmert and all these guys are on the news every single day. And my question has to do with the fairness doctrine. I understand that electoral-wise, when they're advertising for candidates and whatnot, they're supposed to be equal time. However, they have free advertising all year long. When I call the stations here about this sort of thing, I basically am met with scoff, ridicule, and, you know, humorous contempt.
Well, let's talk about that because it's not addressed directly in this report. But, Regina, maybe you can speak to the sense of satisfaction or dissatisfaction that Texans seem to have with media coverage.
I wish that I could tell you levels of satisfaction of Texans in particular. We know that the kind of sentiment that Brandon just expressed is pretty widespread in nationwide polls. There's been an increasing percentage of Americans who feel as though the media are biased politically. Of course, interestingly, that tends to split in terms of is it biased toward the conservative side or toward the liberal side. In the academic world, this is the subject I actually teach in my courses. We call it the hostile media phenomenon, where the bias that we disagree with is something we recognize more readily than bias that we do agree with, which is one reason that it makes it very hard to document strong patterns of real partisan bias in the news, because each of us is an unreliable observer, so to speak, and that just has to do with sort of the way we are wired cognitively. So that may well be part of what's going on. When people disengage from media, of course, the media is a key way that we engage with our larger communities, particularly the communities that we belong to as much virtually as we do face-to-face. In other words, in a very large state like Texas, the media become a key kind of connective tissue for people to feel themselves to be citizens of something larger than just their immediate community. And what we do document in the report is the number of public affairs and political reporting jobs that have gone away over the past decade or so because of cutbacks in the news industry.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Regina Lawrence. We're talking about the Texas Civic Health Index, and we'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Regina Lawrence, who directs the Annette Strauss Institute for Civic Life at the University of Texas at Austin. The Strauss Institute has just published its first ever Texas Civic Health Index. You can find a copy online for free. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. And Regina, before the break, you were talking about the reality that it can be challenging to objectively document episodes of media bias, but it's a slightly easier process to calculate the number of lost jobs in the media dedicated specifically to political reporting.
Yes, the FCC issued a report that came out last year called The Information Needs of Communities, which is also available online. It's a very hefty report and very, very, very thorough, and one of the things they did was to document lost jobs in reporting on politics and public affairs, and they happened to mention the specific Texas statistic in their report.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Emily in Plano. Hi, Emily.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call, first of all. I just want to say, as a 21-year-old college kid, I've heard this from several of my friends that are my age group. This is all generalizations, but that I wanted to confirm a comment earlier about how some people just don't vote because they like how things are. I have had that viewpoint in the past, me personally, but I've also realized that there are several things nationally that I want changed, but I don't feel like I know how to help me and my age group get to the point of, you know, getting out there and voting. And like the last two commenters said on like gerrymandering and media bias, and I just wanted to say that like everyone's kind of touched on everything so far, so it's kind of hard for me to say myself, but I just wanted to call on the fact that, you know, if I'm trying to figure out how to mobilize, I guess, my age group, which without, I don't know, just in general, mobilize them.
Well, what are your thoughts on that, Regina?
Thank you for that question, Emily, because one of the groups that we're particularly concerned with at the Annette Strauss Institute is young people. I mean, it goes without saying that they're the ones who are going to be running the show in the coming years. So how do we get younger people engaged? And I think you're right. The hurdles that you just named, like distrust in the media, unclear about how exactly to get involved, unsure how much your vote will really matter, these are all things that really tend to resonate with young people. Not to be cliche, but I do think that one part of the answer is for more and more groups and organizations and indeed government entities to engage online and social media platforms, because we all know that's where a lot of young people live their lives these days. But there are larger hurdles, as you suggest, and part of it is helping young people simply to come up with their own strategies for feeling more informed. Hmm. There's an interesting paradox that we note in the report that seems to be supported by some research, and that is people, many young people in particular, feel that they need to be better informed than they are before they should get involved. And so this notion of being an informed voter actually becomes a hurdle or even an obstacle to being participating. So young people often reason to themselves, or even, you know, they'll say it out loud if you ask them, well, I probably shouldn't really vote because I don't really know enough about the candidates or the issues. Hmm. And for young people today, I think the media environment is just more complicated than it has been for generations in the past. So part of the thing, I think, is helping young people come up with strategies from all of the media that are out there, helping them figure out a strategy that works for them for feeling more informed.
So I think I saw this discussed in the report. In terms of like K-12 social studies education, this is not one of the subjects that is heavily measured, assessed on standardized testing. Therefore, it sometimes gets sort of swept aside. Does this suggest to you that we need to pay more attention to social studies in regular basic education in Texas?
Absolutely. The research is very clear that well-taught, quality civics education in K through 12 years really does make a difference. It really helps young people to feel themselves to be citizens and to give them the knowledge and the skills that they need. And so some of the programming that we do at the Annette Strauss Institute is designed to do exactly this, to help middle school and high school kids to gain real civic skills, like learning how to work in groups to identify a problem in your community and then taking a solution to adult decision makers. Those kinds of skills are invaluable.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Neil on the line now in Mansfield. Hi, Neil.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Great, thank you for taking my call. My question, I guess, centers closely to the media question. And it has to do with how misinformation discourages some political participation. I do seem to, and I may be biased, but I do seem to hear more misinformation from the Republican Party on as to the things that are going on. And I was just wondering, is there any data that may help explain how that affects participation in the political process?
So in other words, the sense that you're not getting the truth from one party or another or both keeps you away. Is that what you're saying, Neil?
Correct. And okay. It has to do with the issue of distrust in the media.
Mm-hmm.
And is that distrust enhanced by, well, I know this isn't true, or it's so far off the wall that it just becomes laughable?
What do you think, Regina?
I think the circumstantial case, and here I'm talking not just about Texas, but nationwide, the circumstantial case is pretty clear along exactly the lines that Neil is saying, that to the extent that people come to distrust what they hear in the news, that disconnects them from society, from government, from politics. As you said, it's not very motivating when you feel as though you're filtering everything in your mind. So it's a very big problem. How do we restore a sense of trust and engagement with the news? And I'm not sure, unfortunately, that we can just turn the clock back to an earlier era in which traditional news media are as trusted as they once were. I think, you know, for better or for worse, we're in a different world now. And so I know from my colleagues in the School of Journalism at UT, it's a very lively and real question for journalists today. How do we regain or build anew the public's trust in what we do?
Well, so woe to the person who jumps in and defends the way the media cover a lot of different subjects. but I've worked in a number of newsrooms, to be honest, none of which had a deliberate, overt political bias. And yet, as we've heard from several of our callers, some people see left-leaning bias, some people see right-leaning bias. Are there better ways you think that journalists could at least demonstrate that they are trying to be as unbiased as possible?
I think it's very, very tough. I mean, you just hit the problem on the head, and now I'm speaking with my, you know, journalism and media and politics expert hat on.
Uh-huh.
I think it's very tough, as you said, because even when journalists believe that they have practiced all of the standard routines for filtering bias out of their news, and their editors are keeping an eye on them and not allowing bias to creep in, if the public still perceives some bias, then you do get into a very difficult situation, right? How do you ever untangle that knot? So the answer may not lie only in what journalists do. Unfortunately, it's probably a bigger problem than that. How do you also re-engage the public in a way that helps people to realize that even if the news isn't exactly as you would like to see the world, even if you believe that you see some bias in it, is there still something useful you could glean from it? Is there a way that you can talk back to it? It may be that more kind of active citizen role that may hold at least part of the key to the answer.
That's really interesting. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jerry on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Thank you. Got a quick question. I'm a Hispanic, born and raised in Laredo, graduated from the University of Texas. Now I live in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I find myself that the older brothers and sisters are more liberal, vote Democratic, because they didn't move from the county of Webb. But yet, every one of us who left Laredo turned more conservative. We tend to accumulate more wealth. You read more. You see the waste in federal government. So all of a sudden, you start getting extremely conservative. And but my question is, do you see that in your studies, that as one individual gets better educated, more, and reads more, sees the waste in politics and you know, the whole government issues, so all of a sudden, you just tend to want to vote Republican?
Do you have information about that, Regina?
We don't have in our report, but again, I know that the political science literature and just the data that's pretty easy to find supports in general what Jerry's saying, that the wealthier people become, the more they tend to vote Republican and lean conservative in their political views. I am not an expert enough on that literature to know what the precise reasons for that are. I suppose some people would look at that and say, well, maybe that's because they feel that they have then more to protect, right? More to protect from taxation, for example. So there's probably a number of reasons for it. But in general, yes, that pattern is true.
So Texas ranks 43rd in the nation in rates of charitable donations. And, of course, that's not dollar per dollar because we have a larger population, but in the rates at which people make charitable donations. Is this mostly a factor of average income, or could there be other things at work here?
Oh, I hate to keep saying this. I wish we knew. Mm-hmm. I would love to delve into that more because the way that the Census Bureau asks this question is, frankly, a bit of a blunt instrument. It simply asks people whether they've donated $25 or more in the past year to a charitable organization, broadly defined. So at $25, that's not a very fine instrument for us to figure out very much about where people are donating, why they're donating, and how it's connected to those other variables.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't have any problem with you saying I want to know more about this. I'm guessing then, Regina, this report is a tool for you and for the Strauss Institute to begin to decide sort of where you want to invest your resources next and learn more?
That's exactly right, because I think in some ways the report is, we think, hugely helpful because it's, as you mentioned, the first time that we've had all of these data in one place for everyone to see that's publicly available. But it also kind of raises as many questions as it answers, right? Why Texas? Why are the rates so low here? And in a state as large as Texas and as really diverse as we are with this really interesting, unique history, there's just bound to be a number of reasons why participation is lower here. So we think some of the really pressing questions are things around, again, the groups that aren't participating as much, talking to them, surveying them, doing focus groups with them, for example, and trying to find out what is it that has seemed uninteresting, not worth their time, uninviting up until now. That would be just some wonderful research to be able to do.
So physically in Austin, you're close enough to the Capitol that you could almost send this report via paper airplane down to the legislature. Have you had a lot of interest in this from elected lawmakers?
That's an interesting question. I have to say, to my knowledge so far, no. The report just came out last week, so we're hopeful as we continue to try to publicize it that more elected officials will take interest in it.
Mm-hmm. What about other states? Are they doing similar things with these data from the U.S. Census Bureau?
Yes, about 20 states around the country so far have produced at least one civic health index for their own state. A few have already produced more than one.
Mm-hmm.
So Arizona, for example, which is our fairly close neighbor, has actually been a leader in this field, and they have several civic health indices, which is nice because they can begin to track what's happening over time.
Yeah. So I guess the idea, do you think you'll come back to this every 2 years, every 10 years? What is the ideal distance in time?
We'd love to be able to do that. I think coming back every 2 years is useful. I would want to caution everybody that probably we wouldn't expect to see huge changes or fluctuations over just two-year periods.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, for example, you know that voter turnout tends to be higher during presidential election years than midterm election years,
right.
So we wouldn't want to make too much of a change that we saw just over a two-year period.
Mm-hmm.
The other uncertainty is what's going to happen with the census data, and is the census going to continue to field these current population surveys that our data come from? And, of course, being able to do a report like this is really dependent on their ability to field these surveys.
Regina Lawrence directs the Annette Strauss Institute for Civic Life at the University of Texas at Austin, which has just published the 2013 Texas Civic Health Index. You can find a copy for free online. Regina, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect, and our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think and send your comments, questions, and suggestions via email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.